I'd like to thank everybody for coming out today for this press conference on California homelessness. I gotta tell you, this state has some major, major plans for homelessness. I truly think we're going to tackle this problem within the next decade. I really hope so. You know, we're projected to spend about $4 billion over these past 2 years, ladies and gentlemen. But you know what? The problem isn't getting solved. It's actually getting worse. So, you know what we do best? We throw money at it. We're going from $4 billion to $12 billion. Any questions from the press here today?
I have a question.
Yes, yes, Bill.
What about all the drugs?
What about them, sir?
Well, a lot of homeless people are doing drugs. How do you curb the drugs?
You know what? We looked at this issue. We looked at it. A lot of homeless people are doing drugs out on the streets, and we thought, you know what? What's really unsafe about this is that the crack pipes aren't safe. So we contacted this current administration. We gave them our concerns. Now we're giving free crack pipes to all those drug addicts on the streets. It's brilliant. Brilliant.
That sounds like a great idea. What yep. about the mental health?
Well, you know, when we approach this with this housing first model, you know, we find these homeless people, we give them a house, they're in these four walls, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. completely blocked off. You're not going to see the schizophrenia.
Right.
You're not going to see these psychotic breaks anymore. Isn't that what we really want here?
That's
so I think we take the people with mental illness, we throw them in an $800,000 house.
Mm-hmm.
Problem
what
solved.
What if we took the homeless and pushed them somewhere else?
You know, I'm really going to let the citizens handle that. I like the encampments personally. I think they add a little bit of decor to the city. You know, people are putting boulders there to try and stop them. You know, I say we move the boulders. You let them camp. Let them camp. Any other?
What do the citizens think?
Well, I think, why am I paying $3,000 a month for a tiny 500 square foot apartment when I could just be homeless and get a free place, free crack pipes? That sounds like living the dream.
That's exactly right.
I tell you what, sir.
Have some of my crack.
The state of California welcomes you.
It's a new way to do it. All the kids are doing
now
it.
Now you're just
way.
Drinking crack.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, the state of California is constantly innovating, ladies and gentlemen, and this press conference has proved it.
Yeah, drink some crack. That's what we're doing now.
Scene. That was brilliant. Good performance from all three of us, I really say. One of our strongest.
It was probably our best one yet.
There we go. Applause. Thank you. And live from Los Angeles, it's Will and Amala live. I hope you guys are all having a very, very happy Wednesday. You can tell by today's skit, we're going to be tackling the issue of homelessness. And a way that PragerU is personally tackling this issue is by getting people educated about it. We have a documentary coming out called Homelessness, The Reality and the Solution, which we will be talking about on today's show. Plus, we have a couple of interviews of men that we featured in this particular documentary. One of them is Tom Wolf, who is actually a former homeless person himself, and Judge Glock, who works in policy research for this issue, has really tackled the housing first approach that California has been taking over the past few years. And lastly, we're going to be doing our Wednesday segment, which is Am I the A-hole? Which is a segment that they have, or at least a thread that they have on Reddit, where people write in their problems that they're having and asking, am I the A-hole in this situation? So we will be the judges because we have the credibility and the credentials to do so.
Right, because we're all A-holes.
Yeah, so we know them when we see them. You can't BS a BSer, no. Ladies and gentlemen. So before we get into this little clip from the documentary, I'm curious, like, what are your guys' first experiences with homelessness and particularly in the state of California?
Yeah, I mean, anyone who knows LA knows this is riddled with homeless people, and it's a self-manufactured problem where they have done this to themselves.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that is true. I think the majority of people either suffer, obviously, from drug abuse or mental illness, which is something that the state is not tackling. I say this all the time, I came here from Florida, and where I was from, which was a really small, conservative town, probably medium-sized now, but there was rarely any homeless people. You would see maybe one person every 2 weeks, and it's always the same person just like sitting on the road with their cardboard sign, and you go, okay, well, that's unfortunate. And then I moved here, and it was everywhere. Like, I've never seen so many homeless people in my life. It almost looked like there was more homeless people than people actually living in apartments and houses here in LA.
No, I mean, that's what you would think looking at it and seeing these people, seeing tents everywhere you go. It smells horrible everywhere you go because of homeless people urinating and doing drugs and pooping on the street. I mean, the cleanup is terrible by the city as well.
Yeah.
They don't want to spend money on cleanup, but they're fine with spending the money, like we joked about in the beginning, on free drugs, free housing.
What's your craziest homelessness experience?
I don't know if I can even say it.
Really?
It's pretty gross.
Is that bad?
Well, it's not. One of the craziest things that Los Angeles does is that if you're a homeless guy and you go into a vicinity, like let's say you go to an apartment complex and you chill out there, the landlord, in some cases, not every case, the landlord has to evict you. Even though you don't pay money to live there, but you're technically like a homeless resident in the apartment. Mm. And so there was this guy next to one of my buddy's apartments back when I lived in Hollywood near the boulevard. And this hobo, he was like wanking it outside. And he would do it all the time. He would masturbate outside in public, right? And there's not a ton of children around, but it's Hollywood Boulevard. So if you go just a block over, there's tons of kids and all sorts of horrible stuff. And the landlord couldn't kick this guy out. He would call the police and he'd say, oh, he's doing this on my picture. So you have to give an eviction notice. So we had to give this homeless guy who's just sitting on this dirty mattress outside masturbating. Wow. Had to give him an eviction notice.
Wow. That's so ridiculous. I cannot believe
it. It is ridiculous. The guy should be thrown in jail for doing that. I mean, it's sexual assault. It's terrible. It's drug abuse is no excuse for that.
Right.
You should go to jail. They just let him do it.
A lot of them want to be put in jail, too, because it means, like, you know, I get clothes for the night. I get a meal for the night, you know, water, all this stuff. So a lot of them just do stuff on purpose.
Yeah.
But now they're decriminalizing all this stuff. So it's just like, dude, I'm trying. Put me in jail. Like, literally, please put me in jail. And they will not do it.
Throughout history, I mean, what has happened when you have men who don't have jobs and don't have spouses and they're out on the street? I mean, it's we're treated a lot differently today than they have ever been treated throughout history for thousands and thousands of years, you know? Like, what did the men do when they came over into the United States when all those immigrants came? I mean, they found jobs, they found work, they weren't homeless, they made something of themselves. And now it's treated as like, oh, you can just live out on the street and do drugs all day and it's totally fine.
Well, yeah.
And there's no repercussions.
You got to look.
Of course, that's how they're going to live.
Yeah. I mean, and the drug industry and the mental illness problem has just grown exponentially since those times, too. It's like almost inescapable. I see homeless people like walking down the street talking to themselves, and I don't know whether or not it's because they're mentally ill or because they're on heroin. Like, you don't know anymore. No. And it's hard. It's so hard to tell. And there are some homeless people that, like, don't get me wrong, most of them do struggle from mental illness, which I think we should completely be sympathetic to, and I think the state should be doing more about in terms of treatment. But the drug abuse, something needs to be done there. And then, you know, I see some homeless people, like there's a homeless woman who lives near my apartment, and when I see her, it's just devastating. She's like 80 years old. She's completely hunched over. She's like 4 foot tall because of medical problems that she clearly has. And she just walks around the city with a cart. And it's just like, what type of country are we living in that person is not being helped? Whether or not, I don't know whether or not it's been offered and it's been declined. I highly doubt it with the amount of medical problems that this woman seems to have. But yeah, what sort of state are we in that an old woman like that is just being left alone on the street to sleep with a shopping cart? It is ridiculous.
It's tough to know what to do. I mean, sometimes a lot of these people need to help themselves.
We have to be realistic in whether or not that's going to happen or whether or not we need to have a state that does something about it. Like, we see the states, like the city of Houston had a really big homelessness problem and then started building a policy on intervention and helping these people get into treatment and just simply not allowing encampments. And if you were trying to encamp, you either got sheltered or are put into some other facility or simply moved out of the city. We have to consider doing that. And Michael Schellenberger wrote a book on this. We talk about him a lot on the show, San Francisco, where he advocates for something that maybe conservatives would not be too happy about. And that is sort of a state-funded mental health and drug recovery. And it's been proven to work. It's not like he just pulls these ideas out of his butt. He's gone and traveled to different countries, different states, different cities, and seen what they're doing. And he sees that it works. I think the city of Houston decreased its homelessness population by like 25% in 1 year by simply implementing that. So it's just like something to think about. It's something to think about doing. I had a crazy experience the other day. I was driving down the 101 freeway and this homeless guy had like sort of hopped the fence on the freeway, climbed up the little hill that's on the side of it, busted a pipe open and started taking a shower with the water coming out of the pipe.
That's insane. Right.
And he was just on the side of the freeway, had a little, like, I don't know if it was his t-shirt or whatever, just washing himself. He wasn't completely naked, luckily. But yeah, busted a pipe open and was giving himself a shower.
I know.
Yeah.
And our politicians care so little about these people and also so little about us. It's just laughable.
It is. So we here at PragerU decided to look into this issue of homelessness and try to find out, A, what is the reality and what is the solution? And that's the title of our newest documentary, Homelessness, the Reality and the Solution. We have a few clips here. Let's go into it and give our reaction.
Your first reaction might be to say, oh my gosh, all these poor people were on the street. This is terrible. But what's really important is, are you really seeing the underlying issues? Why are they there? And that question is the most important question to answer.
We're all just running through all these camps.
Americans are homeless on any given night. The problem has grown worse in recent years.
Why is a city as prosperous as San Francisco have a homeless problem? Homelessness is a disease, just like addiction.
New encampments have been popping up throughout LA in the last 5 months.
The state of California can no longer treat homelessness and housing insecurity as someone else's problem.
We don't want to be the tip of the spear.
How did we get here?
We don't have time.
And the paramedics are coming to here.
Look on the ground. What is it that you're seeing? You're seeing pieces of foil for fentanyl. You're seeing hypodermic needles, all kinds of evidence that says this is not a poverty problem. This is something else entirely.
Lost at least 5 people that I knew on the street to fentanyl overdose.
They don't want to listen. But a lot of it is because there's nobody teaching them about recovery, about accountability, about being productive, and you can get out of this. It's okay. Stay there on the ground. Nobody's saying, get up off the ground.
Nowhere is the homeless crisis more apparent than San Francisco. The Golden City spends hundreds of millions of dollars each year to address homelessness, yet the problem has exploded. Politicians promise to end the crisis.
We are going to eliminate homelessness by the end of this year.
Only to throw up their hands in defeat. So what went wrong? Why are some cities surrendering while others are reducing their homeless population? As in many cases, it boils down to governance. And nearly all...
Yeah, no duh, it boils down to governance. And that's one thing to point out here is that if they don't have this issue, they have nothing to run on. Absolutely nothing. What will they sell you on that they'll be able to fix if only they have your tax dollars? They will have nothing. And that's why they tell you, oh, we've got this 10-year plan, or just give it a couple years, or let us implement this policy, or just give us billions and billions of dollars to fix this problem. I wonder how much of that they pocket. I'm going to be completely honest here.
No, the administration is so large that a lot of the money never actually gets to the people.
Yep.
That's definitely true. That's even with some nonprofits as well, they're doing the same thing. But politicians create problems so they can pretend to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
And a 10-year plan sounds good because by the end of 10 years, they'll just say, oh, well, we need a new plan now. Yeah, right. They don't have to actually offer any solutions. This is definitely about governance. But, you know, I always want people to look at why homelessness is such a big deal and not just like, what are we going to do now? Mm-hmm. How do we stop more people from becoming homeless?
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes down to the drugs. It comes down to the drugs. It comes down to the opiate epidemic, big pharma, all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's really caused so much damage in doing this because this was never a problem. This was never a problem in human history.
Yep.
And now look at it.
Yep. And all manufactured. All manufactured just for you. Yeah. I watched a video the other day of these old videos that they did when opioids were being pushed to people, of real life patients making commercials for these companies and saying, you know what, I got on OxyContin and now I'm feeling so great and my back pain's fixed and my leg pain is fixed. And then they followed up with those same people 10 years later and nearly every single one of them succumbed to addiction.
Yeah.
And what do you think happens there? Because you get this high, you get this euphoria, and then what? You get off of it and your pain comes right back because all you did was mask it and nobody treated it and nobody did anything because we don't do preventative or proactive medicine in this country anymore. And of course, you're going to want to shield it more. And suddenly those drugs don't work anymore. The drugs that your doctor told you were perfectly safe and Big Pharma told you were perfectly safe and said they were fine no longer mask your pain. So you have to increase it and you have to move on and you have to do more and you have to do more. And eventually that becomes heroin. And anybody who's familiar with the symptoms of withdrawal or being dope sick knows that once you're on it, what is the incentive to get off of it? You're just constantly going to be chasing a high.
Well, and there's no incentive to get off of it if the government encourages it.
Yeah.
Then you're going to continue to do it. Yeah. Instead of being tough on people and saying you can't do drugs because this is terrible for you and terrible for society, they say, hey, it's fine. Come get some free crack pipes.
Yep. So, and I'm sure people who are drug addicted, by and large, have a lot of self-loathing that a substance is able to take control of their entire body and their entire mind. And I'm sure some of them, especially if you walk the streets in California, get so drug addicted that their mind is simply gone. There is there's no thought process on whether or not they should or should not be on drugs, because these substances are so overwhelming that they completely take over you as a human being. So the fact that the state is not intervening and doing something about this to help people who are virtually helpless, because I should stress this, you do get to a point where you cannot help yourself. And that if somebody does not intervene, whether that be a loved one, a peer, or the government themselves, nothing is going to happen.
And also the government not empowering nonprofits to be able to do good work.
Yep.
That's a huge deal, because nonprofits will usually do things, I mean, pretty much always better than how the government does it.
Yeah.
And by not empowering them or giving them the right tools to be able to help these types of people, then you ruin the situation. But again, they want this problem to fester and continue.
Exactly. Let's continue here.
All the cities in crisis have one policy in common: housing first.
And the housing first model is premised on a very simple and almost intuitive idea that if you're homeless, the problem is that you need a house. And so to solve homelessness, we should merely give people homes.
And now this policy is being pushed from the top down.
The program, as I understand it, was started out of New York for the very severely chronically homeless, I believe in the 80s and 90s, and the Bush administration got a hold of it, implemented it. In 2008, under the next administration, it was rolled out as a one-size-fits-all solution.
And there's a lot of appeal to that idea that, look, if this person is going to be on the street for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever it is, why don't we just give them a house and not deal with all of the problems of picking them up, putting them in jail, putting them in a hospital, doing the rest of it. Let's find a central place where we can treat them. The problem with this theory is that if you look at the numbers of what's actually causing people to be homeless, it's overwhelmingly problems with mental health and drug addiction.
And Housing First requires no sobriety or treatment in order to receive permanent housing.
If you're going to put somebody in housing and you don't provide any type of services for them, no treatment services, no case management, no anything for them, you just stick them in the house just so you don't have to look at them, and they can do what they want in there, how are we really helping?
You want to draw someone in and you want to help them get off the street. Right. So what they do is they just say, well, we're just going to allow the drugs anyway. And now you have all these people that are staying in shelters, that are staying in navigation centers, that are living in tent encampments, using in massive quantities.
Man, yeah, it cannot work like this. I take issue now, because back when I was on the left and everything like that, I heard the word homelessness and I thought, you know, it's in the word home. You just need to give them homes. And I worked out of Orlando, and Orlando had one of the biggest, and still continues to have one of the biggest housing crises in the United States of America. And I thought, well, that's why everybody's homeless, because you don't give them a home. Honestly, we need to change the word homeless to something else, because that's what people are getting tricked into thinking, that it's just a housing problem.
Yeah, I mean, it was different things before. I mean,
yeah, it was like vagrants, street sleeper, stuff like that.
Oboe.
Yeah, but it's like, obviously those are not, those words don't have the greatest connotation. We need like a better technical term other than homeless, because it leads people down to the wrong conclusions on these issues. And the medical treatment is a massive thing. The mental health treatment, the drug addiction treatment. I met a nurse one time at a wedding who works for one of these treatment centers where they bring in homeless people who are going through schizophrenic or psychotic episodes or drug addiction. And she said to me, you know, what's really the worst about working in this industry, in this city, is that we can help these people. I will have a patient come in with having a complete schizophrenic episode, and we dose them with medication, whether that's some sort of sedative or something specifically for whatever mental illness or episode they are experiencing. And the voices go away, and they stop having this psychosis that they are experiencing, and they feel so much better. But then you take that person and you go, okay, return to the clinic in a week for another checkup and some more medication. What's going to happen? Nothing's going to happen. There's no follow through with treatment here. So then they're going to say, well, look, this clinic is seeing thousands of patients every single week and helping them with their mental illness, but there's no follow up. So you're just in this endless cycle of trying to help people to no avail.
Yeah. And you give $12 billion to spend on this. Compare that with the about $60 million the state of California used to repair businesses that got destroyed because of the COVID lockdowns. or businesses that were failing.
Right.
You see these people's priorities.
Yeah.
They care about the homeless, care about the homeless. They put all this money into the homeless, but don't actually care at all about the businesses that have been destroyed. And yet the money that they're using, all this $12 billion, does nothing in the first place. So it's all just government waste, all of it.
If the money fixed it, by all means, use the money, allocate it properly, fix the problem. Because not only are you fixing quality of life for the people who live in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, but you are saving the lives of people who are out on the streets. You are saving the lives of people who are going to OD from fentanyl or get hit by a car during an episode. There's just horrible things that happen to these people out on the streets. Something that people don't talk about is in really heavily gang populated areas, the gangs use homeless people as targets, and it's disgusting. And this is going to continue to happen unless we solve the problem.
Fentanyl, heroin, crack cocaine, the city sanctions their drug use within that city sanctioned site that your tax dollars and my tax dollars are paying for.
I mean, it brings tears to my eyes because it doesn't look at the individual. It doesn't look at what his or her potential is, and it doesn't help them develop that. To say that all we're going to do is help them aspire to be like that for the rest of their lives by sticking them in a house and not addressing, excuse me, the issues, it's horrible. I think it's one of the most oppressive things we've done in this century, to be honest with you. And I'm so committed now to getting this changed.
All right. And it should, like, I watched that woman get emotional, somebody who's worked on this and studied and researched and wants to do something about it. And it should be an emotional issue for somebody. And even I can sometimes feel disconnected from people who are homeless out on the streets. And it's something that I get, you sort of callous up as you move here and you experience it more. And as you have bad encounters with homeless people who are very rude or going through an episode or are naked out in the street, it can make you sort of dissociate from them and not see them as people. But you have to sort of reel yourself back in and realize that these are real people. If your grandmother, let's say you have a grandmother who has Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and she's like 85 years old and has an episode where she wanders out in the street and is gone for days and is just out in the street, I don't know, sundowning every day, having having trouble, you would have law enforcement on that. You would have anybody you could. You would send out search parties from your community to go and find your grandmother who is experiencing these same sort of problems that these homeless people experience on a day-to-day basis. But we don't do that for them. Why? Because we don't think they're worth it. We don't think they have loved ones. And maybe they don't. Should that matter? We don't treat these people like they are actual members of our community. We treat them as if they are separate from us. And they're really not. They're really not. And we're going to get into some interviews here. One in particular from Tom Wolf, a guy who had a family, a wife and kids, and developed a heroin addiction and became homeless. That's what happens. That is what's happening to these people. These are fathers and daughters and sisters and mothers and grandmothers who are experiencing this problem, but we just look at them and go, well, that's not a person. And it's horrifying. It really is. That's my rant on this. It makes me very upset.
It's very upsetting.
It is. And again, yeah, I admit that I have those experiences sometimes too, where I'm like, You look away, you don't want to see it, you don't see them as a member of your community, you see them as a problem. And it's because of the way the state treats it, the way they educate people about this, and because we are making this a housing first issue, as if all that these people want is a house given to them by the government. There's problems far deeper than this, and we need to have empathy and be sympathetic to what's actually going on here, because it could be you. It really could. Anyways... let's get into some interviews here. We're going to lead with this interview from Tom Wolf. Like I said, he experienced homelessness himself and is now a recovery advocate helping people get off the streets. Here's that interview. Ladies and gentlemen, special guest on the show today. I'm new to Los Angeles and everything here in California, and I moved here from Florida. And immediately what I noticed was a homelessness problem or issue, if we want to call it that, like nothing I had ever seen before. We live in a state that spends more money on homelessness than any other state in the nation, yet the problem continues to be pervasive. We have a documentary coming out on that called Homelessness, The Reality and the Solution. And a keystone interview in this documentary is Tom Wolf, who is a recovery advocate. Tom Wolf, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Fantastic. Now, Tom, you have a very, very interesting story. You're attached to the issue of homelessness because you experienced it yourself. I'm wondering if you can go through your story and sort of how you got there and how you got to be where you are today as a recovery advocate.
Wow. Okay. Well, so I'm pretty much just your regular guy. I'm middle-class guy. I'm married with two kids. I'm a homeowner. Back in 2015, I had surgery on my foot. I came home from the hospital with a 30-day supply of 10 milligram oxycodone, and I didn't use those pills as directed, and I got addicted to that oxycodone. So instead of those pills lasting me a month, they lasted me about 10 days. I tried to get a refill. I could not because it was too soon. So I started, instead of just letting it go and going through the withdrawals, I kind of gave into those withdrawals because they were so incredibly strong. I got dope sick. That's the term that you hear a lot now. And so I started looking online on the internet of where I could buy pills on the street in San Francisco. And I found a few different pages on YouTube suggesting where I could go buy them. So I went down to Golden Gate in Leavenworth, which is called here Pill Hill in San Francisco. And sure enough, I found five or six people that were selling a variety of different oxycodone pills on the street. And I started purchasing pills off the street. Over the next 2 years, my addiction progressed until I was taking approximately 560 milligrams of oxycodone every single day. If you took that dose now, you would die of overdose. But addiction is a progressive disease, and my tolerance built up. And the levee broke one day when my wife caught the mail that I was intercepting, and she got a foreclosure notice on the house because I had stopped paying the mortgage and had quit my job without telling her just so I could do drugs all the time. And people always ask me, oh, didn't your wife know something was going on? Yeah, she knew something was wrong, but I'll say that denial is a very powerful thing, especially in addiction. And that was gripping us because it was hard for her to believe that somebody that had, you know, she'd been married to for 20 years, we had a family, we had a house, was throwing it all away for these drugs, for this addiction. And at that point, she cut me off from all the money. So I had very little money at that point, and I turned to heroin, which was far cheaper. $10 for an eighth of a gram here on the street in San Francisco. I started purchasing heroin and started using drugs intravenously. And then my addiction just progressed over the next year after that until early 2018, where one night I snuck out of the house, stole some money from my wife's purse, and went down to the Tenderloin to score some dope. And I didn't go home for 11 days. I went on an 11-day bender out there. I was eventually discovered by the police because my wife had filed a missing persons report on me. They sent me home, even though when they found me in my car, I had all kinds of drug paraphernalia everywhere. They let me go. Went home to my wife. She was waiting with a packed bag saying, "I either need to go to drug treatment or you need to get out." And I was in withdrawal. I was dope sick at that very moment. So I opted to leave, and I unfortunately chose drugs over my family. And that really speaks to the power of addiction, the things that normally you would never, ever consider doing, you end up rationalizing and doing in your addiction. And I spent the next 6 months homeless on the streets of San Francisco in the Tenderloin neighborhood, using drugs on the daily, nearly overdosing several different times. And it wasn't until I got arrested, because I had become a mule for the drug dealers out on the street. I was holding their stash for them in exchange for payment in drugs, that I started getting involved into the criminal justice system. I got arrested 6 times in 3 months. The sixth time, they kept me in jail for 3 months, and that's when I got clean. I went from there to a 6-month inpatient program where I found recovery, and I'm now almost 4 years abstinent from all drugs and alcohol. And now I'm an advocate for recovery in San Francisco and the state of California and beyond to advocate for more drug treatment and a sensible approach to the drug crisis, which is directly intertwined with the homeless crisis, not just here in California, but throughout the United States. We have 161,000 homeless people in California, at least. It's probably closer to 200,000. And over 500,000 homeless people in the United States, and a great deal of them are struggling with addiction and untreated mental illness, and we need to do more to help that population. As you've seen, the overdose numbers are exploding. We had 103,000 overdose deaths in the United States last year. This problem is not going away. We're only at the beginning.
Do you see that a lot of the people who are out on the streets had similar stories to you? Or how did most people get on the streets? You hear a lot of different stories about how people are when they're homeless and what they're like.
And that's a great question. So, you know, every county in the state of California and most cities across the country do something every year called a point in time count, where they send volunteers out to the street to count the amount of homeless people on the street so they get an idea of how many people are out there and what services are needed. And they ask them a set of questions. And one of those questions that they ask is, what was the primary driver of your homelessness? What event? And they always, most people say job loss. And so then they check that box and then they come back and say, well, job loss is the primary cause of homelessness. Nobody bothers to ask that individual, what were the conditions that led to your job loss? And if they asked that deeper question, I think they would find that for many of them, it was drug addiction, as it was with me. And so to answer your question, when I was out on the street, 8 out of every 10 people that I saw were struggling with addiction. And whether or not the addiction led to their homelessness or they turned to drugs once they were on the street, the bottom line is that now we have this humanitarian crisis with hundreds of thousands of people out there struggling with drug addiction. And actually, there's over 20 million people in the United States right now struggling with addiction. They're just not homeless yet.
Gotcha. Now, a lot of people, particularly on the left or progressive side, when we're coming to fight this homelessness issue, they package their policies in these really brilliant words like harm reduction. And this is something that you talk about in this documentary. Can you describe the concept of harm reduction and explain why it is actually harmful in its use and in its policy?
Well, it's not that harm reduction in and of itself is necessarily harmful. It's how it's being interpreted and applied in today's world. Right. So one of the original principles of harm reduction was to keep somebody alive long enough in the hopes that they find the miracle of recovery. That's one of the original principles, that someone moves towards abstinence. That, unfortunately, however, has morphed into just maintaining someone's addiction indefinitely. And that is not safe, and that actually causes more harm. And in large part, that is changed because of the drugs that are on the street. We have a more toxic drug supply now. We have the arrival of what they call illicit fentanyl or fentanyl analogs on the street, which are drugs that are smuggled in, you know, made in Mexico and smuggled up to the United States that are like fentanyl, but they're made in a clandestine lab by the cartels. And those drugs have caused the overdose crisis to explode all over North America. Canada has a huge problem too. And so how can you reduce harm around that? And I think that's the question. And for me, the answer to that is to promote recovery and to promote drug treatment and to start making some hard decisions and trade-offs about what to do with those that are already on the street that have fallen all the way into homelessness that are no longer functioning. How do we help that population so that we can keep them alive, but also help them find a better life in recovery?
And what is the government's role in that? When you talk about recovery, what should the government specifically be doing different, or the county, or wherever it is in San Francisco or LA or Vancouver? What should they be doing differently?
That's a great question. And that's a question that's up for, you know, big time debate. And it's reached all the way to the top levels of government. You heard the president speak about that in a State of the Union address. So I think this is one of those areas where we have to consider socialized medicine for addiction and mental health specifically. In California, a statewide addiction and mental health treatment system would be of great benefit to the state, because right now all of these addiction and treatment systems are left to be managed at the county or city level, and it's all farmed out to nonprofit organizations with almost no financial oversight whatsoever. So people are just running whatever program they want. This is one of those systems that needs more regulation from the government so that we can actually create a real pathway where we monitor and track everyone's data, and so we can track their medical histories and things like that to help people get into recovery.
Amazing. A question here that sort of falls outside of the scope of homelessness, but more around addiction. I'm hearing from a lot of people that are experiencing this in their personal lives with their family members. And of course, in California, people see addicts on a day-to-day basis, and some of them have personal relationships. How do you start approaching that conversation with somebody that you love and care about when you want them to be taken care of? You want them to start seeking out recovery. I'm curious what happened with you and how you were affected by it.
Yeah, that's a great question, because when you love somebody, you know, you want to take care of them, you want to do what you can to help them. But I had become like a terror to my family. I don't know how else to say it. I was stealing money from not just my wife, but I was stealing money from my parents, borrowing money from other family members, missing events, forgetting to pick up my kids at school, all these terrible things, driving under the influence with my kids in the car, all these things that I had to own in my recovery. And at a certain point, to protect, I think, their own sanity and well-being, my family had to practice what they call separation with love, where they had to say, look, we love you, but we're going to have to back off. And I think where we as a society can play a role, as a community can play a role, is we can come in there and say, you know, look, the family's under a lot of strain right now, but we as a community are going to provide all these treatment resources that are easily accessible to you, so it can make we can make it easier for you to make a decision. And I think that's one of the things that gets lost in a lot of these conversations, is that it's not easy to access drug treatment anywhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. You can't just walk in somewhere and say, hey, I want to go to treatment right now. It takes anywhere from, you know, if you're lucky, it's a day, but it can take up to 50 days in San Francisco to access a treatment bed, because we have to pull all your medical history and you have to have an ID and they have to check all these things about you and then find a patient-centered treatment center for you. It's really convoluted. So if you're on the street already and you're homeless and you're ready to get help, there is no easy way for you to do that in San Francisco or anywhere else in the United States.
You talked about when you were going on your 11-day bender, that the police found you and they just took you back home and you had all these drugs and things on you. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a problem with the police and the justice system not being tough enough on some of these people who are drug addicts or criminals who might be out there, or homelessness in general? And that, like you said, when you went to jail, that's when you got clean. Do you find that that would be helpful for people as well, to be more tough on some of these people?
Well, that's kind of, there's like a two-part answer to that question. And the first part is that we have something in San Francisco, and LA has it, and Austin, Texas has it, et cetera. They're called open drug scenes, and they're euphemistically referred to as homeless encampments. But what they really are, open drug scenes, where you have a bunch of people gathered together that are unhoused, that are using drugs on the daily. Okay. And with that, you know, they're getting their drugs from somewhere. They're getting them from drug dealers. And in San Francisco, what you have is you have organized cartel fuel drug dealing out on the street that are dealing in plain sight, open air, right on the street corner in the hundreds of people. It's not just like two or three guys. It's like 300 dealers that are out there on the street. That element needs to be removed. And that's where the criminal justice system can come in and make a huge impact. You know, the police, by having smart policing where we're targeting and focusing on organized drug dealing to remove that element from the street, would help a great deal, because then that would give then all the service providers an opportunity to come in to the people that are struggling on the street with addiction and say, hey, we know it's hard to get the drugs right now, but we can offer you this pathway to get off of those drugs and get into recovery. And I think that that blend of public health and smart policing is the solution. They're doing that effectively in several cities in Europe. If you study what's going on in Amsterdam, for example, and everyone, when I was growing up, we all thought, hey, drugs are legal in Amsterdam. That's what everyone always said, you know. But really what they did is they went in and broke up those open drug scenes, offered drug treatment for the users, and punishment for the people that are selling those drugs that are killing people. And that is the trade-off that we're eventually going to have to come to realize and make in this country.
Tom, I'm curious, with the work that you're doing as a recovery advocate, how could people support you in the work that you're doing in their daily lives? What can the average person do?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing is drug education and education around addiction. And, you know, a lot of people don't care out there about, you know, people that are homeless or people that are struggling with addiction. A lot of people just kind of sign off as like, that's just part of the way it is and all that. But, you know, I'll tell you what, with what's happening out here on the West Coast in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and to a lesser degree, cities like Fresno and San Diego, where you have this explosion in young people that are on the street using drugs every single day, young people that could be working, that could be contributing members of society that have already given up and they're in their 20s. That's a big red flag. That should be a big red alert for people to let them know that there's some type of breakdown happening along the way. And so what I try to do in my advocacy work is I try to educate people about addiction itself and how it's a progressive disease and how it implants itself into your survival instincts in your brain and makes you, you know, make really irrational decisions. And then also educate people about the humanity of the fact that these people out on the street are your brothers, sisters, family members, et cetera. So we do need to have compassion. But I also try to educate people that the bottom line is that this is largely driven by drug addiction and untreated mental illness, coupled with other issues like housing and wage inequality and all those things. There are shreds of truth in all of those things. But what gets downplayed constantly is the issue of drug addiction and mental illness. And they do that because they're trying to destigmatize the people that are out on the street, which I understand fully, as I was one of those people on the street. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this is one of those crises that if you're not honest, then you can't really address the root problem. And also, if you're not honest, then the money that's coming from the government, et cetera, is not being spent correctly to address the issue. And this is what we're running into now in California, especially.
Gotcha. Well, Tom, I just want to say you have an amazing and very, very inspiring story. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you so much for spending your time to come on the show today.
Thank you. It's more than my pleasure. Thank you so much.
A truly amazing story from him. I can't imagine having gone through all that and to get yourself out of it in some way, and then to fight for other people to do the same and to fight for their recovery. So much of what the homeless people here in the state of California lack is somebody to introduce them to a light or a guide to make their lives better, because you sit there and you're doing drugs all day and it's a quick fix and it's a cheap fix. And until somebody comes to you and says, you know, your life can be so much better than this, what are you going to do? You're going to continue chasing that. And again, our state is not handling this issue properly. Many states are not handling this issue properly. And we are moving with a housing first initiative. Now, this next interview is Judge Glock. He is a policy researcher for the Cicero Institute, who's done lots of work surrounding this housing first model and why it is truly a failure. So let's get into that interview. Ladies and gentlemen, an issue that we cover a lot on this show is homelessness. Of course, Will and I are no strangers to it, living in Los Angeles and in just the state of California alone, one of the states that spends the most money on the problem, yet it is still continues to be super pervasive here, particularly with drug abuse and mental illness. Now, Will and I are not experts on the subject matter, but we do have experts here at PragerU that are welcome to come and talk to us about this. So today we have Judge Glock, who is a senior director of policy and research at the Cicero Institute, and also makes an appearance in our newest documentary, Homelessness, The Reality and the Solutions. Judge Glock, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So let's get into a little bit of your background and how you got into these issues. How did you get into policy and research, and what alerted you to the issue of homelessness?
So I was formerly an economics professor. I was teaching over at West Virginia University, and in fact, had a focus on economic history. But inside that, I focused a lot on housing, mortgage market, local urban issues, and so forth. I frankly had never focused much on homelessness per se, except insofar it was tied into housing issues and bigger problems in urban areas and so forth. But when I moved to California and San Francisco specifically about 3 years ago to start working with the Cicero Institute, a new think tank that was starting up at the time, I couldn't help but be struck by the homelessness problem in the city. And as someone who grew up in Washington, D.C., I thought I knew a little bit about homelessness and how bad it could get, but I had seen nothing like what I saw in South of Market and the Tenderloin in San Francisco. So I started diving much more deeper in the issue, started looking at the connection with housing and other urban issues. And unfortunately, as perhaps we can go into more, one of my biggest surprises was to learn that it wasn't predominantly a housing issue. And a lot of my previous expertise about housing was not exactly relevant here. So I had to get more involved in a lot of these related issues that you already mentioned about drug abuse, mental illness, and the social services sector more broadly.
And so what do you think is that big issue when you're talking about that it's not about housing? What do you think is the real main driver of this? Or is it multiple things?
Well, it's definitely multiple things. And there's multiple different kinds of homeless people, as one would expect. What the majority of homeless people are actually in shelters. We don't think of that as being the homeless. When we, in our mind, think of the homeless, we often think of the individual on the street. But in fact, a large majority are in shelters, and they're in fact not too dissimilar from most working people in America. They have short-term financial issues. They often, they usually leave the shelters within 6 months. They get back on their feet. Sometimes they return, but most likely they go back about their business. About, you know, 2 to 3 million Americans experience this kind of temporary homelessness every year. That's a broad spectrum of Americans. But the kind of homelessness that you and I think of when we think of homelessness, or most people do, is street homelessness. And now that is a minority of all the homeless. It's around 170,000 people in America, but it is very distinct in terms of what those people look like. And we can talk more about like the particular problems with mental illness and drug abuse, but those mm-hmm. are very prominent among that population in a way they aren't for that short-term sheltered homeless.
Now, you talk in depth in this documentary, and you've written in depth about this sort of housing first approach that people take to homelessness, and specifically the state of California. And when I was, you know, a former leftist, I looked at the issue of homelessness and I thought, well, it's in the word. The root of the word is home. So that's the way we fix it. We give them houses. And it seems to be the way that California is trying to approach this. What exactly is a housing first approach to homelessness, and why is it problematic?
Yes. Yeah, so like you said, the solution seems to be embodied in the very word itself. Mm-hmm. But ironically, the word itself, homeless, is a creation kind of the 1970s and 80s, where people did try to redefine homelessness as merely the absence of a house. That wasn't the operating assumption for most of American history. You know, they had some very unfortunate terms for them, you know, vagrants, tramps or whatever, but nobody assumed the problems with a particular kind of poverty were just lack of a house. Mm-hmm. Homelessness was a way to reframe this in a way that made it a purely housing issue. So the housing first idea kind of took the policy world by storm in the early 2000s. And Philip Mangano, the head of kind of homelessness czar in the George W. Bush administration, supported it. A lot of cities began to adapt housing first strategies. Former mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco, in fact, said, you know, using housing first, we can solve homelessness within about a decade. And then California more broadly adapted a mandated housing first strategy in 2016. So a lot of cities began to adapt this. The idea said, if you're on the street for a long time, basically over a year, we're not going to try all these other solutions. We're just going to give you a basically free house and hope these other problems kind of solve themselves. Unfortunately, there's a lot of reasons that hasn't worked out in practice.
And what are some of those reasons?
Well, the basic idea is the fundamental confusion that a reason someone is long-term homeless on the street is just because they lacked a house, that the problem was, say, a short-term lack of rent money or something. But we know by studying this group and surveying them that this is not their main problem. If they, as Tom Wolfe, who was in the documentary, said, he said, well, if you ask me why I was homeless, he said, it's because I lost my job. But then you ask him, well, why did you lose your job? And he would say, well, because I was doing heroin in the bathroom. During breaks. And well, that's why I lost these jobs. And the surveys we have now say about 75% of this unsheltered, the street homeless, have a severe mental health issue, basically schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, the two major ones. And 75% roundabouts has a severe substance use disorder. And the vast majority have both, or at least one or the other. So if you have those problems, merely giving you a home is not going to fix them, and it might exacerbate them. Especially if these high numbers are probably underestimates. I would say I was recently doing a homeless count. Cities are required to account of the homelessness every year in their city to receive federal funds. And I was talking to one of the homeless workers out there, and I'd say, "Well, how many do you think have a mental health issue or a substance use?" And he said, conservatively, 100%. And this is kind of the consensus. If you're on the street for a long time, it would be shocking if you did not have a severe mental health or substance use issue. And that's what we find. And despite a lot of promising evidence in the early years that, hey, maybe housing first will help get people to start taking treatment, getting rehab for substance use, that just doesn't seem to be the case.
Gotcha. And you write a lot at the Cicero Institute about sort of encampment cleanup and just mass movement of these encampments. What exactly does encampment cleanup look like? Because I know a lot of people will say, oh, well, you're just going to move them and they'll just go somewhere else. And the problems will continue. The mental illness will continue. The drug abuse will continue. What does real encampment cleanup look like in a city that's doing it right?
Well, one of the surprising things, in fact, is there's any opposition in the idea that you should clean up large encampments on public property, even on sidewalks. Mm-hmm. There was a report just 6 years ago about the rise of tent cities in American cities. And, you know, if anyone remembers to the early 2000s, even with lots of homeless problems, you didn't see large encampments in public streets just about anywhere. But now in a lot of places, it's kind of assumed, it's de rigueur that you have these encampments, you can't do anything about them. So the idea that they should just kind of be allowed to exist and spread is also kind of new and strange to me. But, you know, what we find when cities actually enforce them, and, you know, we do find that broad sectors of the American populace support that across parties, across racial lines, across everything, that they do not believe you should be allowed to kind of camp out wherever you want. They believe that you should be, you know, kind of pushed and encouraged into a shelter or into a safe space. When the cities do clean these up, we find the vast majority go back to either friends or family, where most of them came originally. A lot of them were short-term kind of residents and couch surfers, a lot of friends and family. Some of them go back into rehab. Some of them return to the shelters. A lot of the times these places have hundreds of empty shelter beds, but you have people camping right outside because they don't like the restrictions of them, which most often involve the substance use rehab and mental health screenings. And so, you know, when you have these encampments, you actually clean up, sometimes called abatements, you actually see people go into these safer environments and you see deaths go down. You see crime against the homeless go down. When the opposite happens, when they start allowing encampments suddenly, and I'll use the example of my hometown right now, Austin, Texas, when they legalized street camping in 2019, all of a sudden you saw an over 40% increase in unsheltered homelessness and a 20% decrease in the people in the shelters. So you had people clearly leaving the shelter space, going out to camp. And not surprisingly, you saw a double-digit increase in homeless deaths. You saw more people dying out in the street. The reverse happens. When places like San Diego or LA, which temporarily enforced camping bans from around 2006 to 2014, you see incredible reductions in homeless deaths because you, not surprisingly, don't have a lot of mentally ill people with maybe severe drug addictions living unsupervised on the streets, which, as I often remind people, is not compassionate by any sense of the term.
Do you think that the amount of money that's spent on homelessness now, there's a great deal of corruption there? I mean, we have $12 billion being spent in California for the homelessness crisis. Where is all that money going and where should it be going if not to the right places?
Well, there's a lot of developers that do make a lot of money off this, and we get a lot of government subsidies to build housing first apartments and programs. In LA, there's this referendum HHH, which gives $1.2 billion. And they recently did a city audit of this and found these single tiny homeless apartments could cost up to $800,000 per apartment, you know, well above what a typical LA nice condo would cost. And, you know, studies of these in general find they're much higher costs. A lot of these higher costs go to, you know, what can people in the development industry called soft costs, accountants, planners, engineers, financiers. There's a whole industry that's kind of created out of these very complicated, very sort of mandated and rigorous programs for the homeless and for affordable housing more generally. I always cite former mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown. He used to call the affordable housing industry the sacred cartel because of how they sort of shrouded themselves in this kind of holy image, but then raked in billions of public subsidies. So, you know, whether or not you call that corruption, I think is sort of open, but is there any doubt that there is a large industry on about this and that lots of people make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars off this? No. And is there any doubt that cities like San Francisco or LA, which have built thousands and thousands of these housing first units, are better off or have reduced homelessness from when they started doing that 10, 15 years ago? Again, I think people would agree, no. The cities that have built the most of these, and in fact, have seen the most increases in homelessness, which maybe is not surprising if you're kind of economically minded, that offering a lot of almost free homes to people might encourage more people to move into them and move into the states that provide them.
Gotcha. Last question from my part here, Judge. What can the average person who's living in a city like Los Angeles or San Francisco do to make this move further, make the legislators and the policymakers in their city do something about this? Are we writing to our representatives? What is it that we can do on a daily basis to make this change?
Well, I mean, one of the best things you can do is is one, encourage the some of these camping bans, which again would sound for some homeless advocates like a contradiction in terms that, well, how are you going to help homeless people by, quote, criminalizing it? But again, as I mentioned, that's not actually how these things work in practice. They often encourage people to go back. And you've even seen in Los Angeles, I think it's mayoral candidate Kevin DeLeon has said, you know, we have to have some sort of enforcement here. So you can encourage that. You can encourage the cleanup of Skid Row in L.A. like LAPD Commissioner Willie Bratton did from 2006 onwards. And you can also encourage the movement of these funds out from the Housing First into things that seem to work better, like mandated substance use and mental health treatment. One of the main problems of Housing First that I didn't mention is that if you get a Housing First unit, because the focus is so on housing, it's actually illegal for the nonprofit that runs those to have anything like a sobriety check or a mandated sobriety or any restrictions on, say, taking your pills. And I've talked to nonprofits who say, hey, listen, I'm trying to encourage my clients, the people who live here, to quit drinking, but I literally get wrapped on the knuckles by the state and the federal government who says, no, you have to allow them to drink as much as they want. So helping move some of these funds from housing as a solution into treatment and helping enforce the laws in the streets, which is good for the homeless and good for the communities in which they live. And finally, you know, participating in a lot of the great nonprofits out there. I don't want to name too many names, but, you know, some groups like the Salvation Army just do fantastic work in this regard. And any way you can support them, especially some of their adult rehabilitation clinics, goes a long way.
That's fantastic. And how can people support you if they're listening to you right now and they want to know more about what you think and what you write?
Well, you can go to just the ciceroinstitute.org to see some of our writings on housing, homelessness, and other related issues. You know, we operate, and I testify in numerous states. If you're interested and you think there's some problems with the homelessness funding, with homelessness laws in your states, feel free to reach out to us. We work on mainly the state level, and we're always happy to try to work with local or state groups to try to change the laws. We have, you know, model legislation and other things in place that can really help move the needle on some of these issues.
Fantastic. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we might have a problem with homelessness, but it seems like there's a solution. Just got to look into it and push for it. Judge Glock, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing all this information with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me again.
A big thank you to both of those guys for doing interviews with us, appearing in the documentary. Really helpful people and support the work that they're doing. You guys can go to prayegu.com to make sure that you watch the rest of the documentary about homelessness and also all our other content that won't appear on YouTube or Facebook or anywhere else. Prayegu.com is the way to stay updated with big tech censorship always pushing PragerU down.
Okay, heavy stuff in today's episode, but I hope you guys liked getting a deep dive into some of these issues because I know you guys are curious about it, so we wanted to bring people who are familiar with it to you. Now we're going to We're going to answer some questions. We did a deep dive on the Reddit thread, Am I the A-hole? I pulled some interesting questions from the thread, and we're going to ask them, and we're going to make our judgments. Is this person an A-hole? Always probably a fun thing to do on a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Number one. Am I the a-hole for not telling my daughter I'm aware of her lifestyle until almost a year later? Okay, so this is very ambiguous. Who knows what's going on here? So my daughter, 25, she lives a fairly wealthy life. And when asked by family, she says she invests stocks, crypto, etc. I know she does, but that's not even half of her income. She does OnlyFans and Twitter and PH. I'm not sure what PH is.
Pornhub.
Great. I'm aware of this because you answered that very quickly.
Well, it's in the context of OnlyFans.
I'm just noting that. I'm aware of this because I will admit a single man in his 40s has needs, and I recognized it as her right away. So I'm assuming he went on OnlyFans and PH and saw his daughter. Oh gosh. I clicked on the Twitter profile and her face was the profile picture. I blocked her and made a note of the name so I wouldn't come across them anywhere else and felt kind of weird myself. But I didn't bring it up to her. That was a year ago, and a few days ago she finally admitted at a family function what she does. Mixed reactions and anger aside, I did let her know I knew and I respected her choice. Too, as long as she was being safe and knew she was okay with this
being online forever. This is poorly written. She got really upset with me and told me I shouldn't be watching those kinds of things and that I'm disgusting, vile, etc. She hasn't talked to me since, and I get her disgust in it, but is it really that bad that I never told her? Am I the a-hole for not telling my daughter I know what she did for work?
I think they're getting this whole situation wrong. You're the a-hole for not telling your daughter to stop. You should have told your daughter to stop with that nonsense and get a real job.
Yeah.
That's what a good dad does. Good dad doesn't let your daughter go on OnlyFans.
I would have reprimanded her, or at least I at least would have tried to have a discussion about why this is not helpful. I wouldn't have screamed or anything or gotten super angry, because obviously that doesn't help. You tell somebody not to do something and then they hop out the door and I'm going to do it even harder now. But definitely would have had a discussion about the risk versus benefit on this one.
Yeah, I definitely don't agree that just because you tell someone not to do something, it means they're going to do it even harder.
She's 25.
Yeah.
She's going to do it even harder.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think if you're a good parent and you have a good relationship with your kids and have worked on that for, you know, your whole life being a good parent, then they're not necessarily going to be that way. But if you're like this and don't tell your daughter to not do OnlyFans, then potentially.
The hypocrisy is interesting. Her being mad at him looking at sexual content when she creates sexual content for men.
Right. So he's
like, come on.
I mean, he obviously parented poorly.
Maybe.
If that's what his daughter is saying, you know, lashing out at him like that and also starting OnlyFans and Pornhub and all this. I mean, there's never enough context in these things.
No, there isn't.
But you should have told your daughter no.
Yeah, I would have had a very, very long talk about why this is very bad for her and her life.
Yeah.
Very, very bad.
Yeah.
Also, I hope she's made enough money to retire at whatever age she stops doing this, because she will probably not get a normal job after such a thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have that experience. But
no.
Probably not.
Probably would not be able to do normal work after this.
No.
Taylor, you've been quite quiet. Any thoughts?
I mean, I'm mostly with Will. Just the fact that she's doing this in the first place suggests to me something about the parenting.
Yep.
And and at this point, I think, the right thing to do is to confront her and, you know, give as soon as you find out and give the reasons why this is a bad idea. And hopefully you have a good enough relationship for that. And you approach that in a way that's not going to, you know, cause her to, you know, resent you or run away or whatever. But it's just a terrible thing.
And here's the problem with this country and really the world is that this makes you very wealthy. He says in the beginning, she leads a fairly wealthy lifestyle. Yeah, no duh. She's probably making thousands upon thousands of dollars a month from doing this. Thousands.
Yeah.
And then making
to get someone to stop and say, oh, I'm making thousands of dollars. Now get a office job.
Right.
And make, you know, piss.
Yeah.
You know, like,
go make $20 an hour sitting in a cubicle instead of making $20K every single month doing this.
It's for posting your butt online.
Yep.
Other things.
And they just go, you know what? Totally worth it. Totally worth it. So you're not the a-hole, but
you're the weak hole.
Maybe be a little stronger.
Yeah.
But he does say that she respects her doing this as long as she's being safe. So maybe it's his opinion that sex work is okay for your daughter.
Boo.
To each their own, I guess.
I would. Oh my goodness. I don't know what I'd do.
I would approach it calmly because she's already doing it. It's like, okay, it's already out there. So I would approach this in a calm manner and just go, you know what? This is not a good thing for your life. You should scrub the internet of all of this content as quickly as you possibly can, even though people have this. It's permanent. Like, it's done. Yeah. People have your pictures and they will know you for this for life. Bunch of random strangers.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. Yeah. Next one here. Am I the a-hole for yelling at my husband over the gift he sent me at work? My husband was away for 2 weeks. The day before he was scheduled to come back, he sent me a gift which was delivered to me at my office. He made it seem like it was something harmless, like chocolates or perfume, and kept telling me to open it. I did open it, and it turned out to be lingerie. It was embarrassing because some of my coworkers saw it and made jokes about it. When my husband got home, I was still really upset that he would send that to work. I immediately asked him why he had, and he just laughed it off and said he wanted to make sure I got it. We had a fight because he was acting like it wasn't a big deal and I should be happy to see him instead of getting upset over a gift. I did yell at him at one point, and he told me he wasn't going to give me another gift because I yelled at him and was acting ungrateful. Am I the a-hole? This is a convoluted one. It's nice you sent a gift. Probably not the most appropriate one for the workplace.
Yeah, you shouldn't send that to work. I'm going to be honest.
But does she need to be upset about it?
If it's a funny joke, I mean, it can be a funny joke,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Right.
Because she was embarrassed. That's the point of the funny joke.
But if it's not funny for both of you, is it a funny joke?
Yes. It can still be funny. But I understand why she would be upset.
He's being a little insensitive and she's overreacting.
Yeah.
Let's get married on this.
Yeah.
I'm a big thing of like, if something already happened, what is the use of being upset about it? Just communicate, hey, babe, don't send lingerie in front of my coworkers. And then you move on. Why would you be fighting about something that's already happened and already done? It's not going to change what has already happened in your work environment and what has already happened with this gift. And it's not like people don't know you're married. Like, come on. They saw your lingerie. Ooh, it's so horrible. It's crazy. Yeah. You kind of are the a-hole.
He should get a follow-up gift of a vacuum cleaner and send that to her.
Straight up. Yeah. Is this more suitable? Is this more suitable for the workplace? Yeah. No. I would say you are 75% the a-hole.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he took the time out of his day while he was away, I'm assuming for work, to send you a gift and get it delivered to you. That is very nice.
Yeah, but I would also have to know the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot depends on the relationship.
Yeah. Right.
Because if the guy is like a funny guy and people know him for this and he's likable and nice, then it's more her.
Right.
But if he's like weird and not cool.
Well, it's her husband.
This is strange.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can have weird and not cool husbands.
I guess.
But
she said he did laugh it off like it was funny.
Yeah, but apart from it being a joke, like if you've been away from your wife and you want to communicate that you've been thinking about her and stuff, like it can be a sweet thing to do something like that. But it could also be like, you know, daddy's coming home, I'm going to get what I want.
Oh, like this is all I'm thinking about?
Yeah, and it's not really about like you're being thoughtful, it's more about yourself. I think it could, depending on the context of the relationship, I think that could be a factor why she's reacting.
Daddy's coming home.
Daddy's coming home.
I think it's cute. I think it's a good gift, but yeah, I get it. Maybe not appropriate for the workplace. Last one here. Oh, this one's long. Okay, this one's weird. Am I the a-hole for not sharing my dinner with my diabetic roommate and causing him to have a hypoglycemic episode?
No. Definitely not. That sounds familiar. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
I, 23 male, rent with three guys, Ty, Michael, Simon. Simon has diabetes and he's having a hard time managing it. Here's how the problem started. I'm the last to get home. I arrive at 8 where the guys are all home. Every time I order food from the restaurant, I'll ask the guys if they want an order as well. They say no, but at first, once my food arrives, they gather around me in the living room and help themselves to my food. Oh, it irked me a lot since it kept happening, and I'm too nice to tell them off. Oh, I can relate. Days ago, I came home to Simon sitting on the couch. The other guys were still out. Before I ordered food, I asked again if he wanted some, and he said no. This time, to avoid having to share my food, I decided to go in my room once the food arrived. Not gonna lie, I got some looks from Simon, but I thought nothing of it. I went to bed at 11 p.m., and at around 2 a.m., I woke up to a loud knocking on my door. I then opened the door and Ty yelled, saying that Simon had a hypoglycemic episode and Michael drove him to the hospital after I refused to share my dinner with him earlier, from what I understand. He didn't eat for hours and was counting on eating dinner with me, but I took the food to my room and he didn't get any. Ty and I started arguing after he called me a selfish F for hiding, withholding the food, and letting Simon go through this, knowing he was diabetic and can't stand without food for long periods of time. He thanked God they recognized his symptoms and took him to the hospital early. I said I already asked Simon if he wanted to eat, and he said no. Ty said it's because Simon was going to say that since he had no money to buy food and was hoping that you would just share with him instead. I said that I wasn't obligated to pay for others' food, which set him off about how horrible my attitude was over a few dollars, but money is an issue for me. Simon hasn't talked to me, but Michael and Ty kept blaming me and said that they no longer trust me around Simon. Moreover, Michael called Simon's parents. I had an argument with him because of this, and he said, I have no excuse for treating a diabetic like that. I've been getting a lot of bashing from them over that, and I've been feeling incredibly guilty, thinking that I might have contributed to this in a way. Am I the a-hole?
No. I mean, everything from the story points, obviously, no.
Yeah, I think so, too.
You offered him food.
You offered him food.
Yeah, he said no, it's not
he
your fault.
He said no,
right.
And then the food gets there, and he doesn't say anything. What are you supposed to do?
People are responsible for themselves. Like, I get he has a condition, but all the more that means you need to understand your condition and be proactive in managing it. You can't put that on someone else, especially if they offer you food and you say no. That's not
right.
Yeah,
you're all roommates, and you're 23 years old, which I'm assuming these are all grown adults.
Yeah.
If you are a grown adult with diabetes who's not capable of monitoring your blood sugar and your levels, and you know that if you don't eat for a considerable amount of time, that you'll be hypoglycemic, you should handle that.
I know. I used to, one of my best friends, you met him, Ezra. He is a diabetic guy. And all the time, he would always steal our food. He would steal my food all the time. He'd be like, oh, I'm feeling low. And then he'd have to take some of my food. It's like, get your own food. Get your own food and you don't have to take my food. It's, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, you're not, I don't think you're the a-hole in this situation.
No, not at all.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And just, you guys can all check in on Simon every now and then, but also Simon should be checking in on himself. Unless there's, for some reason, unless there's a reason that Simon cannot check his blood sugar and make sure that he's...
Did people vote on this on Reddit, right? Did most people agree with us? Or is it?
It has 17,000 comments. I'm assuming most people agreed with us on this one. Yeah. I think most people agreed. I think most reasonable people agreed on all these things.
Yeah.
Should.
Goodness gracious. Next time we'll actually go through the Reddit responses and see what people say. But yeah, no, you're not the a-hole in this situation.
No.
I think that sums up the show. Three a-holes judging other a-holes.
Mm-hmm. That's us.
Thank you guys so much for watching. Please like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every single day when we go live. And drop down in the comments below, do you have any crazy homelessness experiences? Because we sure have our fair share of them living here in California. I'm very curious to see yours. I'm sure they are extremely unique. So drop that in the comments down below. We're going to be back tomorrow with some fresh stories, fresh takes, and Throwback Thursday. So we will see you then. Bye, guys.
See ya.